Welcome to the PoliticalBetting.com Polling Matters podcast. My name is Kieran Pedley. Well, this week's show will be split into, I guess you could say, two and a half parts. I'll explain the half in a moment. So the first part is me speaking to German political expert Nina Schick. I wanted to understand what's going on in Germany at the moment. There seems to be a surge in support for the German Social Democrats led by Martin Schulz. And I wanted to understand why that was the case, but also what that might mean for Brexit and for Britain's relationship with Germany. We've always thought that Angela Merkel was somewhat untouchable as Chancellor in Germany, and I wondered whether that was still the case, and I thought I'd get some expert opinion, and Nina was kind enough to agree to speak to me. So the first sort of 10 minutes of this show is a reasonably short interview with Nina. The second portion of the show sees me being joined by regular sort of podcaster Leah Barassi, and we are talking about the latest Polling Matters opinion survey. Now, on this week's survey, we look at the prime ministers of the past 30 years, which obviously is Margaret Thatcher onwards, and we conducted a nationally representative poll via Opinium, and a big thanks again to them for that, looking at whether or not the public think that each of those prime ministers from Thatcher onwards had done a good job, a bad job, neither, or whether people didn't know. And we looked at some of those numbers, not just at an overall level, but also by Labour and Conservative voters, and we came up with some quite interesting findings that I thought were not only interesting in their own right, but also quite pertinent to some of the ongoing political situation that we see in Westminster today. Now, as part of that survey, we also asked whether Theresa May was presently doing a good job or a bad job. Neither, I don't know, again. So we could sort of compare how Theresa May is perceived now to how some of these past prime ministers are perceived as well. And Leo and I also, in addition to talking about this poll, talked about some of these rumours around the Labour leadership. There has been some buzz, since denied by the Corbyn team, that Jeremy Corbyn is considering his position as Labour leader. Maybe not immediately, but at some point in the future. And it's particularly interesting that this seems to be coming from the left of the party rather than the sort of usual suspects, if you like, in the PLP. So Leo and I were discussing whether we thought that was realistic and who might replace him if he does. And then finally, at the end of this show, I'm going to be reacting to news that will be breaking as we kind of record today's podcast on the Article 50 vote. I don't think there's much doubt that it will pass, but there is some debate about who will vote which way and what that might mean for the immediate political future in Westminster. So I'll be giving my sort of snap reaction to that at the end of this show, which is why I sort of referred to it as sort of two and a half parts. That'll just be a brief bit of me talking at the end. So, as I mentioned earlier, the first sort of 10 minutes of this show is me speaking to Nina Schick about German politics. Now, I should manage expectations slightly on this 10 minutes. The audio is not as great as I would like it to be. That is entirely my fault rather than Nina's. Nina was speaking to me from Berlin via mobile phone, and, you know, with the best will in the world and some of the best editing I can do, the audio isn't as great as it could be, but I still think it's okay. And Nina was kind enough to spend the time to talk to me, and I think what she had to say was very interesting. So I would, after some umming and ahhing, I decided to put it up less than perfect, although I've done my best, rather than sort of not put it up at all, which would have been a real shame. So with that caveat in mind, here is my interview with Nina, and I started off, as I did last week when I spoke to Nicholas White on Northern Ireland, by asking Nina to give us a bit of an overview as to the main runners and riders, if you like, in German politics. So I'm here with Nina Schick today to talk about the latest developments in Germany. Hi, Nina. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Kieran. Thanks for having me on.
So I guess, Nina, it's worth, for those of us that aren't necessarily too familiar with German politics and the different parties and leaders involved, it's probably worth you just explaining briefly some of the different parties, some of the different leaders, and I guess kind of what we're looking out for as we approach the elections in the autumn.
Yes, so there are several political parties in Germany, and of those, the most prevalent and the two kind of parties that have dominated since the end of the Second World War are the CDU in combination with their Bavarian sister party, the CSU, now that is Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats. And then you also have, they're on the centre-right, and then on the centre-left, their main opposition has traditionally been the SPD. And you also have a few smaller parties like the Greens, Die Linke, who are from the former kind of communist bloc of Eastern Germany, and you also have the FDP, who are the economic liberals, and now, interestingly, a new party, the AfD, who are the populist party in Germany. But in Germany, I think the main thing you have to know is that it's all about coalition building once the elections have been won and the Bundestag seats have been divided. It's about which party has the most seats in the Bundestag and who they will govern if in power. So it's all about coalition.
Sure. And right now, it's a grand coalition, isn't it?
Yes, so that's something, again, which is not very unusual in German politics. A große Koalition, a grand coalition, is when the centre-left SPD rules in conjunction with the centre-right party, the CDU, Merkel CDU. And interestingly, this has been something that has been quite toxic to the centre-left SPD because they've been the junior coalition partner for the past 4 years. And something that Angela Merkel has been very good at is taking the SPD's flagship policies and making them her own. So the SPD basically loses a lot of its voter traction because it seems as though, you know, they don't have a criticism that's leveled against them is that they're not very different from Merkel's Christian Democrats.
Yes, I'm sure there's a few Liberal Democrats over here listening to this and feeling very sympathetic. That said, the SPD seem to be surging in the polls at the moment, don't they? I mean, what's behind that?
Well, it's very interesting because, of course, given the political background we've seen since the refugee crisis started in 2015, internationally at least, the headlines were that Merkel was slipping in the polls, and it's true that her party came under increasing pressure. But the other side of this story, aside from Merkel's own party slipping in the polls, was that the centre-left SPD was doing terribly, really, really badly. And part of this reason is because, again, their policies were seen as being too similar to the CDU's, and on things like the refugee crisis and so on, they actually supported Merkel's policy. And the leader of the SPD, Sigmar Gabriel, who was the vice chancellor, he was also seen as, he was not very popular. Now, recently, we've had Martin Schulz step into the fray a few weeks ago back into domestic German politics. He, of course, used to be the president of the European Parliament, but his basically stepped up as the leader of the SPD, and he's going to be the chancellor candidate in the elections to come, so he will be battling against Merkel. And his kind of reintroduction into the domestic political fray has seen the SPD in a huge bounce, and that's why the SPD is doing really well when it comes to the polls recently.
And I guess the million-dollar question here becomes, is there any actual risk that Angela Merkel might not be the chancellor after the elections?
Well, I think that Martin Schulz entering the domestic scene and becoming the chancellor candidate makes it a lot more challenging for Angela Merkel. I would still say that Angela Merkel, thus far, I still think that she will win the election. However, if Martin Schulz succeeds and he's able to build, you know, a broad coalition of the left through the SPD, Die Linke, the Greens, then it's possible that he could become the chancellor based on a coalition of the left. However, I think, interestingly, at least from the perspective of your audience in the UK, if Martin Schulz becomes the German Chancellor, I think that would make Brexit negotiations far tougher for the UK. If he's already, he's avowedly a European Federalist, he used to be the President of the European Parliament, and he's already made a lot of comments about how the UK can't be given anything for free in the Brexit negotiations, and that he'd be willing to take an economic hit in the name of European solidarity. So I think the important thing for people to remember is that if Angela Merkel doesn't become chancellor, then the other likely candidate, Martin Schulz, is A, much more of a European federalist, and B, actually far more onto the left of the political spectrum.
Sure, and you mentioned earlier that coalition building is, you know, the name of the game, if you like, in German politics. So presumably that means the smaller parties are very important. Are there any particular smaller parties you think we should be paying attention to?
Well, traditionally, what, you know, the kind of smaller party which Merkel's CDU has preferred to go into coalition with is the FDP. These are the economic liberals. So they're kind of, you know, perhaps most similar to the economically liberal part of the Tory party in the UK. The interesting thing, however, is that for these smaller parties, they have to win at least 5% of the vote in order to actually make it into the Bundestag. Now, the FDP wasn't able to do that in the last election, which is why Merkel's CDU went into coalition with the SPD. So I think that for the SPD, with regards to the election coming up, as for the smaller parties, I think one thing is evident. The far-right AfD is going to make it into the Bundestag, so they're going to smash that 5% threshold. But nobody will be willing to go into coalition with them because they're still very toxic with regards to their position in the mainstream. So I think the two most interesting things will be still what share of the vote is the CDU going to get and what share of the vote is the SPD going to get. And depending on that, it's like I mentioned before, it might be possible for the SPD to build a coalition with the smaller parties, the Greens and the Linke. But if they don't win enough of the vote, then it's quite likely that you might see another grand coalition, which I think is the most likely outcome at this point.
Sure. So it sounds like even though coalitions are really important, actually, we should still be looking at that horse race between CDU and SPD. And if the SPD are, you know, ever do end up ahead of the CDU, then maybe Merkel is under threat. Final couple of minutes, I just want to talk a bit about the Brexit negotiations. You mentioned obviously Martin Schulz there, and if he becomes Chancellor, things could get a lot more dicey. But I mean, what is the perception in Germany around Brexit and how these negotiations are going to go? I mean, listeners to this show will know in great detail what Theresa May thinks and the Article 50 debate that's going on in Westminster at the moment, but maybe they won't be particularly close to German politics, and dare I even say, editorialising a little bit, we might not get an accurate view of that for our own press. So, what is the sort of German view in the sort of political class, if you like, at the moment?
Well, the first thing to point out is that Germans felt really dismayed that Britain voted to leave the EU. They saw the UK as a very important ally and a strong partner at a time when the other main European partner, France, and France and Germany just don't see eye to eye in the future of the Eurozone. But secondly, having said that, once the Brits did vote to leave, the German position has been rather clear that, once you vote to leave, you cannot have a deal that is as good outside as inside, and that's quite evident for them, because they said this is a club where there are certain benefits, and if you choose to leave the club and you don't want to contribute anymore, that's absolutely fine, but there has to be some kind of price to pay for that, which is why the Germans are particularly concerned about this idea of cherry picking that the Brits could just want to try and have their cake and eat it too, as Boris Johnson has said in the past. So that's like a question of the Germans thinking that they want to be fair in the negotiations, so they don't think their position is overtly emotional or political. They think it's a very fair position in which to start the negotiations, that in order for the Brits to have access to the market, which the Brits of course want to do with a broad-reaching FTA in the end, there will have to be some kind of price to pay, and if the Brits don't want to pay it, then that access will have to be restricted. Now, one interesting thing is that political developments around the world with, the resurgence of a particularly boisterous brand of Russian nationalism under Putin and the rise of Donald Trump in the United States means that Germans almost feel that they're almost like the last bastions of a Western liberal democratic order. So I think seeing Brexit, seeing Trump, seeing what's happening with Russia, they almost see this as increasing instability in the neighborhood. So they'll have to put the security of Germany first and try to maintain the solidarity of the European Union as well. And that will certainly filter through to the Brexit negotiations.
Sure, it'd be very ironic, I suppose, if we ended up with left-leaning leaders in Germany and France after what's happened in Britain and America over the last year or so. Nina Schick, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Well, that was Nina Schick talking about German politics and the situation there. Certainly an interesting interview. I hope the audio was sufficiently okay for people. It is something that I'm looking at for interviews like these for the future. The feedback I get is that, you know, 99% of what we do is okay, but when we're trying to do Skype interviews or interviews down the line, it can fall down sometimes, and that is something I'm looking at investing some cash in to try and make better for the future, because I do think it is quite useful to be able to speak to people remotely. One imagines people like John Christopher Buer, who's on regularly, and others, guests that will be in the future. So watch this space. But on the substance of what Nina said, it was interesting that, you know, Angela Merkel may be under threat as Chancellor. We're not 100% sure yet. But if she is, it'll be from the left, and it'll be from Martin Schulz, someone that is very keen on European integration. So possibly not a good thing for Britain if she were to go and Martin Schulz were to replace her in terms of getting the best deal possible. Although, I think if we're all honest, I don't think that Germany's position will be fundamentally, radically different with either at the helm. I think they both have similar objectives in what they want to get for a Brexit. And as Nina says, it does seem like Germany's position is that Britain will, you know, shouldn't get a better deal externally from the EU than internally. But of course, you know, Brexiters will say that's not necessarily it's not in Germany's gift to give us our destiny, as it were. You know, maybe we'll be better off outside anyway, and regardless of what Germany does. That is, of course, the heart of the debate around Brexit, and that will rumble on. But certainly, not just because of Brexit, but Germany being a very important European country and an important ally of Britain, an election to watch closely, and I'm sure we'll be revisiting that election between now and when Germans go to the polls later in the year. So, moving on, the next portion of the podcast is me speaking to Leo Brassi about our latest Polling Matters opinion survey, which I explained at the beginning of this recording, what we were doing there. So without further ado, here is Leo and I discussing some of the mechanics of the survey and what the findings were. So just for the benefit of listeners, I'm going to take you through some of these findings. So for this week's survey, we looked at the prime ministers of the past 30 years. That, of course, meaning Margaret Thatcher onwards. I didn't go any further back than that because ultimately, I don't think people are going to know or have an opinion on people like Wilson and Heath. And if we went back to Churchill, let's be honest, I think he'd have very, very positive ratings for obvious reasons. So what we did with the prime ministers from Thatcher onwards is we asked whether they had done a good job, a bad job, or neither, or don't know. And we, as we did last week with the leader ratings for Corbyn and May, we took a net score subtracting the people that thought they did a bad job from the people that thought they did a good job. So we have kind of one takeaway score that we can look at for analysis purposes. So, for example, with Margaret Thatcher, 40% thought she did a good job as Prime Minister, 35% thought she did a bad job, 25% either didn't know or said neither. And that gives her a rating of +5 overall. So I suppose there's two broad ways you could look at some of these numbers. One is to look at just purely the percentage that think each Prime Minister did a good job. And if we did that, we would have Thatcher on 40%. 40% thought she did a good job, as I mentioned a moment ago. Major, 20%. Blair, 22%. Brown, 13%. And David Cameron, 26%. Another way you could look at this is by the net ratings, as I mentioned, subtracting bad from good. So Thatcher is the only Prime Minister in the last 30 years with a positive rating. She had +5. Major, -11. Blair, -27. Brown, -35. Cameron, -16. So I suppose whichever way you look at the results, Margaret Thatcher seems to have been perceived by the public as the Prime Minister that did the best job out of anyone in the last 30 years. Leo, what do you make of some of these numbers?
Okay, so the single standout thing is clearly that Thatcher is, by quite some distance, the one most seen to have done a good job. So that's both on satisfaction score, where she's on 40%, and the net satisfaction, where she's on +5. I think the other thing that really strikes me is if you look at it purely on net satisfaction, which I think is useful because here we get a sense of both their sort of, it's not quite popularity, but let's call it that, and their unpopularity. If you do that, then it comes quite clear that we've got a Labour-Tory divide. So the three top, Thatcher, Major and Cameron in that order. And then a fairly substantial gap, 11 points, to Blair and then to Brown. So really interesting that looking back now over the last 30 years or so, the public are quite clearly seeing Tory prime ministers as better than Labour ones.
And before we move on to Labour, what does that say for Thatcher's legacy? Because I guess, you know, she was an incredibly divisive prime minister at the time. I think that's a fair thing to say when you look at the miners' strikes and all the things and poll tax riots. And, you know, her agenda had passionate supporters, but also passionate detractors. But it almost feels like if we compare her to others, her legacy is really aging quite well, isn't it?
So I had a look at how they were seen at the end of their time as Prime Minister. I used Mori's satisfaction scores, and these are slightly different scores, so the numbers aren't directly comparable, but I think your ranking is very relevant. Now, on net satisfaction and just overall satisfaction, Major Blair and Brown were pretty much indistinguishable. All of them finished on between 32 and 35% satisfaction and had pretty much the same net satisfaction. And then Thatcher and Cameron, similar and both lower. So Thatcher, really interestingly, when she left office, was the least popular of these five prime ministers. So satisfaction 25, net satisfaction of minus 46. Now what's happened since then is Thatcher has become more popular, going from the least popular to become the most popular. And Blair and Brown in particular have become less popular, going from both joint first, most popular in their last month in office, to now the fourth and fifth, the most popular, the least popular out of the five we're looking at.
Yeah, so it does seem like, I guess on Margaret Thatcher though, we should also say that she still divides opinion even now. I mean, so she has 25% neither or don't know, which is the least. So even though she was the longest time ago in terms of when she was in office, people have an opinion on her, or they're more likely to have an opinion on her than anyone else. And a plus five score, although better than everyone else, is probably as much a reflection on how unpopular or how much people thought other prime ministers did a bad job as it is on sort of her popularity. Because, you know, you've got 35% saying she did a bad job and 40% saying she did a good job. So I suppose her legacy is divisive, but obviously stronger than other people's. On the Labour point, I mean, you raise an interesting issue, which is that for whatever reason, Labour voters don't seem to, for want of a better phrase, forgive their leaders for being in office. When I look at some of the net scores, so I talked about earlier, taking bad away from good, in terms of whether they did a good job. Among Tories, Margaret Thatcher has a plus 69 rating, which is, you know, huge, obviously. Cameron plus 36, Major plus 11. And obviously Tories don't like Blair and Brown. So they like their past prime ministers. Among Labour voters, Blair's net rating is minus 4 and Brown's net rating is minus 1. So I guess near the zero mark, meaning you get just about as many Labour voters say they did a bad job as that they did a good job. Now, obviously, we don't need to go into what Labour voters think of past Tory prime ministers, because as you might expect, it's pretty negative. Although as an aside, I would mention that Labour voters seem to dislike Cameron more than Thatcher at the moment. What does that say about the psychology of Labour voters, Leo? Because, I mean, it's obviously a problem for the party, isn't it?
So I think there's firstly a relatively trivial sort of process point, that these are obviously people who are voting Labour now. And what was interesting is that current Lib Dem voters like Blair more than current Labour voters do. And that might be a function that the people who like Blair have now defected from Labour and are voting Lib Dem. But I think there's a wider point and quite fundamental issue for Labour and for the nature of who can win elections in the UK, which is really that Labour are no good in general, as these numbers show, at making the case that Labour governments are a good thing. Mm. And in contrast, Tories are really good at arguing, essentially, Tory governments are a good, wise, sensible, helpful thing for the country. They clean up the mess that Labour governments leave. And that really means that it's just fundamentally harder for Labour to make the case that they can be trusted in power in a way that the Tories sort of have in most people's instincts, that at least they can do a good job.
I'm minded to compare the Labour Party in Britain to the Democrats in the US. Obviously, we've just come out of a tumultuous US presidential election. If President Obama goes back to the Democratic Convention, if President Clinton goes back to Democratic Convention, hell, even if Hillary Clinton goes back to Democratic Convention, despite, you know, the Bernie fans, if you like, they're going to get a rapturous reception, aren't they? And yet in the UK, I don't even know that Tony Blair would get let in. And I'm not sure about... I think he'd get booed off the stage. Gordon Brown is maybe a slightly different one. I reckon he'd probably get a decent reception.
Well, but that's interesting you say that, because as you pointed out, even among Labour, current Labour voters, they're still no better than evenly split on whether he did a good job or a bad job. Which, I mean, I sort of... I find really hard to believe, or fascinating at least. So one of those questions that would be really interesting to focus group to understand: what is it that Brown did that Labour voters don't like?
Lose, I imagine, for some of them. But anyway, let's move on. We also asked about the current Prime Minister, Theresa May, and whether she was currently doing a good job or bad job. And we found that 39% thought that she was doing a good job. That's eerily similar to the 40% that think Thatcher did a good job. 24% think that May is doing a bad job, and 37% neither or don't know. So that gives Theresa May a rating of plus 15, which means if you compare her to all of the past prime ministers of the last 30 years, Theresa May is more popular, more than a honeymoon period, it seems.
Yeah, she has clearly been having good poll ratings.
Are these numbers comparable? I mean,
so that's where I'm going. I mean, I think it's interesting to see that, and I think there's some use to see that she is seen now as doing as well as Thatcher did. But honestly, I think there's a cognitive bias that we have where we tend to remember how prime ministers or how something was at the end of its period. So when we think back to Brown, we think about the sort of hapless later period. When we think back to Major in particular, we think about him and struggling on with a couple of MP majority. And it's just much harder for us to remember earlier periods. So I think comparing May as she is now with the numbers of how we remember past prime ministers who had their start, middle and end, I think is a slightly unfair comparison. But I think what we can do is look at that number of good job and compare it with how prime ministers were doing when they'd been in power for what are we sort of getting on for 6 months now. And May clearly is doing well on those grounds.
Yeah, I think it's a useful way, maybe, of not saying that she's going to become the greatest prime minister in British history, but more to say when you compare to past prime ministers of the past 30 years, she's clearly in a very strong position. I think we have to move beyond the idea that this is a honeymoon period now. I think she's bedded in. Let's see what happens with Brexit, but she's clearly handled the first 6 months. She's defined herself early in a positive way, and we always talk about on this show, don't we, that, you know, leaders get they have to define themselves early, and she seems to have done so positively. There's one number I do want to bring out. Her net rating amongst Conservative voters is plus 74. It's huge, and it goes back to the podcast last week where we were looking at the leader ratings of her versus Corbyn. I mean, when across a number of measures, Theresa May has exceptional ratings amongst Tory voters. You can barely get 5% to disagree about anything positive about her. Margaret Thatcher's rating is plus 69. So I'm not sure I would necessarily go as far to say that shows May is more popular than Thatcher among current Tory voters, because the numbers are quite similar. But it does show that, you know, you can make that argument, and it does show what a strong position that she's in, doesn't it? And I guess it also reinforces the argument we were making last week that, you know, May has the Tory vote full square behind her, whereas Jeremy Corbyn, you know, very much doesn't with Labour. There have been rumblings, though, this week, haven't there, about Corbyn's leadership. I mean, what do you make of some of that? I think there's been some sort of cryptic discussion of maybe a potential leadership challenge, and what's Clive Lewis going to do?
Yeah, I mean, clearly on the wider numbers, May is in an infinitely stronger position than Corbyn. It seems, it sort of has felt for a little while now that the Corbyn loyalists were beginning to pay attention more to the polls and take them seriously. And I think, you know, it wasn't a ridiculous argument to say that Labour was doing badly in the polls because there was a leadership challenge and the party was divided. Look, they were doing badly in the polls before. Whatever. That's now over. There's no more excuses. This is how Labour does in polls under Corbyn with MPs who are not being rebellious. And I think that does seem to have come home. It seems like the mechanics of any challenge would probably determine how it happens or when it happens. So clearly the left of the party would be very worried that if they set off a challenge, they either might not get a candidate in the race or their candidate might not be in a position to win.
Because this is the difference now, isn't it? What people seem to be suggesting is that Corbyn may face a challenge from his own side, which is very different from, I don't know, let's say Dan Jarvis or someone on the... Maybe people are going to hammer me for saying he's on the right side of the party, but, you know, someone that, you know, is considered to be part of the PLP clique and, you know, on the right, challenging him. And again, it becomes the PLP versus Corbyn again, then, doesn't it? PLP versus members. Whereas the difference now seems to be people are talking of Clive Lewis potentially. I'm sure there'll be other names put into the hat. Him being challenged by his own side. It's an interesting idea. I have my own theory on how this might work, though. Originally, I suspected that Corbyn isn't going to, you know, stand down for his own anointed successor, because where's the trust between the Corbyn wing of the Labour Party and the rest of the PLP? I wonder whether you might see a situation where someone like, for argument's sake, Clive Lewis gets into the race over Europe, and Corbyn then, seeing a sort of acceptable successor on the ballot, withdraws from the race.
So right, but you need the process of getting him on the ballot in the first place, right? I mean, that's the hurdle that any challenger from the left would have to overcome.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I guess the question then becomes for the PLP, do you think that it's better for you to have a leader that you don't 100% agree with than one that you just think is going to lead you to oblivion? It's almost like it's just the best of two least bad options, maybe. But what I don't know in that, so that's convinced, I sort of convinced myself that I can see a scenario where Corbyn, right, his name automatically is on the ballot, we know that, but maybe he withdraws gracefully if someone that he finds acceptable gets on the ballot. I guess, though, what he can't then really control, maybe, is whether others pile in later. But I suppose if he stays on the ballot until, you know, the vote closes,
nominations,
then he can do that. Do we think that's likely, though? Because, I mean, with the greatest of respect to some of these left-wing columnists that seem to be turning against him or losing faith or whatever, why do we think they're going to influence the membership? I mean, I wonder whether we're just sitting here... There does seem to be a mood change, but at the same time, are we just going to get a YouGov poll in 2 weeks that shows 70% back Corbyn again?
Yeah, so honestly, I would love there to be a YouGov poll of members. I think that is really the thing now that this conversation needs to move it on. I think after Corbyn's first 4 or 5 months in charge, I thought that things were going sufficiently badly that members would be beginning to doubt their decision to have voted for him. But then we got a YouGov poll 6 months in that showed members being more supportive of him than they had been initially. Mm-hmm. So my instinct was wrong there, and I wouldn't want to trust it now, even though the noises do feel like a lot of people who backed him first and second time are saying that they no longer do. And I think it's not just that they are people with prominent voice like Owen Jones and George Monbiot, but it just sort of feels indicative that there's a lot of people who are thinking that this is not working.
It would be odd if Europe became the thing that destroys Corbyn when that didn't happen immediately after the referendum. It would be a strange scenario. Caution advised, I think, but there are interesting noises coming out of the left, which is different to what happened last summer. Final word, last minute or so, on the speaker. I saw that Habib posted on PB about the odds on Berko not seeing 2018 through, essentially standing down a speaker or being replaced a speaker before 2018. 5-1 are the odds on that. Is that a good bet? I mean, he's obviously stuck his neck out in the last couple of days, hasn't he? But do we really think his position could be under threat? I mean, before we even go into that, what do you make of what he did?
Yeah, I think I'll sort of, I mean, I don't know the mechanics. I mean, ultimately, this comes down to what Tory MPs will do. And I don't know the mood of that. But it sort of feels like what he's done. And this is saying that he wouldn't want Trump to speak in Parliament or to address both houses of the Parliament. It feels like the kind of thing that really rallies Tory MPs against the person that says it, because it feels quite obviously both interfering in statecraft and what governments do and stuff like that, and also it feels disloyal to a Tory Prime Minister. Mm. And both of those things are things that I can really see properly winding up Tory MPs. So I mean, I don't know what conversations might be being had, but I'm surprised that the odds are that long.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand people have sympathy with what he did, and there was a lot of hollering and clapping in Parliament, and lots of people on social media very happy about it, but I don't know. I think that I don't like whataboutery in politics. It seems, often feels like the lowest form of argument, but I'm going to use it anyway. you know, when people do respond by saying, well, hang on a minute, you have the head of this state or the head of that state on a state visit, it's quite hard to then argue that it's fine to ban Trump, but we're not going to ban the president here, there, or everywhere. So, Theresa May well find Trump there for the next 8 years. So she's got to deal with the reality of governing and all the important issues she's got to deal with. So she can't really be beholden to public opinion. I guess I'll close with one final comment on Theresa May. I mean, one of the things I don't necessarily think that people are getting their heads around is quite how long she could be Prime Minister for. If we look at some of these numbers that we've been discussing today, plus 74 raising amongst Tory voters, arguably, if you think the numbers are comparable, more popular at the moment than any Prime Minister over the past 30 years, very likely to win the next general election, which would give her another 5 years from, let's say, 2020. Theresa May could be here for a decade or longer, potentially. I know Tories always get knifed by their own side in the end. But she's got to think of the long game, and there's no indication really as to why she should be worried about that not taking place. So that was Leo and I talking about the latest Polling Matters opinion survey. Lots covered there. It's very interesting that Labour voters seem to dislike past Labour Prime Ministers in a way that Conservative voters do not for past Conservative Prime Ministers. I suppose it's not that shocking that Margaret Thatcher comes out on top. But although we might see May's current popularity as temporary, or maybe not, that's up to you, it is striking how close she is to Margaret Thatcher among Tory voters. Now, the last couple of minutes of this podcast, I just want to react to events that are unfolding as I sort of edit this podcast on Wednesday evening. So the House of Commons has just voted by 494 to 122 votes to invoke Article 50. That it involves no amendments passing, which I don't think should be too surprising in reality, though perhaps, the most surprising thing or striking thing is Labour's support for that, or at least Corbyn's support for that. I think it's about 50 or so, maybe 52 Labour MPs voted against triggering Article 50, one of them being Clive Lewis, and there will be lots of rumours as a result about his potential future leadership ambitions. I don't expect him to indicate anytime soon, but if Labour does badly at the end of this month in the Copeland and Stoke by-elections, as in if they lose both of them, then he will be in a strong position. But I suspect he's not going to come out and say anything about Corbyn's leadership anytime soon. I suppose that whole soap opera is really a matter for the Labour Party. It will be interesting to see if YouGov do produce any new polling as to whether Labour members are moved at all by the fact that Corbyn is being, you know, attacked by his own side, if you like, and over Article 50. We can be sceptical about that a bit because, obviously, it was immediately after the EU referendum vote that he was challenged before. So I just wonder whether the absence of a YouGov poll showing that Corbyn still has 70% of Labour members is what's sort of leading to a lot of this speculation that he might be weakening, you know, his support might be weakening amongst people that support him. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see if anything comes out from YouGov. But for the country, well, clearly this gives Theresa May lots of wriggle room, lots of room to manoeuvre, if you like, in her negotiations. Maybe that's a good thing.
on balance that she's not hamstrung by the other sort of parliamentary restrictions. Although, to be honest with you, personally, I would rather they had guaranteed the rights of EU citizens to remain in the country. I understand the whole bargaining chip thing, but I think it would have been a good statement of goodwill and moral high ground for the country to do that. I also think it's the right thing to do. But I think ultimately now Britain's fate rests in the hands of what the Prime Minister is able to negotiate. And as we spoke about earlier on the show with Nina Schick, that is not 100% in her control. Other nations, not least Germany, but others as well, of course, in Europe, will have their view on what they want the sort of EU-British negotiations to look like. And we should always remember that we might see the Westminster story and what right-wing Conservatives want or what Theresa May wants, but there's an awful lot of other countries in Europe that are going to have their say too. We can only hope that it ends up going our way, or at least there aren't significantly negative repercussions. I will hold my fire on that. You know, let's wait and see what happens. People have been wrong on all sides about this debate so far, so time will tell. But that's all we've got time for this week's politicalbetting.com Polling Matters podcast. If you like what you hear, please subscribe on iTunes, leave us a comment and a nice rating. Some of you have already, which is really great. Likewise, on the Podbean app or other Android-related apps that you use. Do share the podcast as much as possible with others. It does help get our name out there and grow our listenership. It's very much appreciated. We still get new people arriving at the podcast even now. I get messages occasionally every week. So believe it or not, you do get new listeners, even though you're sort of 2 and a bit years in. But that's all for this week. Do keep your suggestions coming for new polls and new topics. Otherwise, we'll be back next week, likely talking about France, but also, of course, the fallout from today's vote.